Good morning again. The court calls United States v. Treat. Thank you. Councilman Lee Powell.
Chief Judge Baker, members of the court, may it please the court. The military judge committed plain error when she convicted Sergeant Treat of a charge substantially different from that described in the specification upon which Sergeant Treat was arraigned. The government charged Sergeant Treat with missing the movement of a specific aircraft.
Counsel, why isn't this waived?
Your Honor, this is not waived. At the minimum, it should be looked under forfeiture.
No, why isn't it waived? 905 would say it's waived. Why isn't it waived? Not forfeited, no plain error, just waived.
I believe, similar to what Judge Ryan said in the concurring opinion in Marshall, the defense counsel made this her central issue on closing argument. That was enough to put the military judge on notice that this was a central problem.
That was a case involving a 917 motion. We said it was preserved.
Yes, Your Honor.
There isn't any such thing here. Why isn't it waived?
I don't believe it's waived, Your Honor, because of the closing argument and the defense that she put on throughout the trial. That whether this court would even look at a plain error analysis or an abuse of discretion analysis, and I understand you're asking whether it's an affirmative waiver. There certainly was never an affirmative waiver put on the record.
That's not, no. But why isn't it waived by the inaction when the judge entered findings by exceptions and substitutions and they sat there mum? That's a waiver.
Well, Your Honor, we would disagree. We would argue that this court should look under plain error. We would argue that if this court finds error and prejudice, it is a clear and obvious error because of the closing argument made by the defense counsel, as Judge Ryan pointed out in her concurring opinion in Marshall.
It was a concurring opinion.
It was, Your Honor, but I think that's what put the judge on notice that there.
Concurring opinion?
No, Your Honor, not the concurring opinion, the argument that the counsel made. She made a clear argument that the government has actually proven that the movement that they alleged Sergeant Treat missed never happened. And the soldiers were told, you're not going on it, at Joint Appendix 175.
Now, the CCA had the opportunity to find a waiver, and it did not. So in the off chance we get to the substance of this issue, how do you deal with the fact that you say the nature of the offense was changed by the judge's substitution?
Yes, Your Honor.
But as I read the judge's substitution, it went from flight TA blah 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 to the flight dedicated to transport the main body of one of the 154th Engineer Battalion.
Yes, Your Honor.
So it's a flight number to a flight with a specific purpose. Now, I'm not sure it's pretty clear what that's about. I mean, is that really a fatal variance?
We believe it is, Your Honor. We believe that change was to a Article 87 C2A type offense, the movement of a unit. And that's what the Army Court found.
No, it's a movement of the flight dedicated to the union.
But even if this court,
unit.
Yes, Your Honor, even if this court finds that it's actually just a movement of a specific flight, that's not what the Army Court found, and the government has not appealed that decision. In fact, the government conceded at page 2 and page 12 of the brief to the Army Court that the military judge had, in fact, found missing the movement of a unit. That caused the appellant, when he worded his assignment of error, to presume that that's what, in fact, had. So the question is whether there's a material variance. But even if this court accepts the idea that it was merely the change between one specific flight to another, the military judge broadened that flight to one that the appellant did not defend against. The charge is very specific. It's very specific. And we have no idea if flight TA-4 B-702 ever took off. It might have taken off on the 17th of November with some other unit. It might have taken off on the 19th of November with Sergeant Treat's unit. It might have never left. We have no idea. So if this court would even see it in that context, this case is much like Marshall, where they charged a escape from custody of a specific individual. And the government came in and proved escape from custody from a completely different individual. So here, the military judge would have at least changed it to a different flight, a flight that appears not to even be known until the soldiers actually walk onto the aircraft. The nature of the offense was changed when the military judge changed it to a C2B offense and she broadened the offense. This court analyzed in Tofoe a violation of a regulation that prohibited recruiters from engaging in inappropriate relationships with members of the delayed entry program. He was charged with a specific subparagraph of that provision that prohibited recruiters from giving alcohol to these members. When the members struck out that line and basically found him guilty of the greater provision of inappropriate members, this court found that was a broadened offense and there was a material variance. The same applies here. The identity of the offense was also changed by the military judge's findings by exceptions and substitutions.
Well, what you're really arguing is missing movement's got two alternative charges.
Absolutely.
You know, missing the movement of flight acts or missing the movement of the 154th Doodly Boo Battalion.
Which can move right. in any manner in the...
Which can move by locomotive or whatever. And what you're saying is that you changed it from A to B.
Yes, Your Honor.
The judge changed it
from... She used the word flight.
She used the...
She used the word the flight.
Right.
Still a plane.
But the way that the appellant reads that is... That's merely the mode of movement of the unit, meaning the main body of 54th Engineer Battalion. But even, as I said, even if the court disagrees with that and is merely substituting a different flight than one charge, we still have serious identity problems with the nature, the way that the offense was charged originally and what the military judge ultimately found, just like the case in Marshall.
Well, counsel, I understand that you can make that argument here today, but you don't disagree that the defense counsel was in the best position to evaluate whether it was a problematic change and did not object to trial.
She did not make a specific objection after financing. That's true, Your Honor. She did make an objection at in 1105s, but this court found in Finch, one of the reasons it found no prejudice was because there was no objection on 1105s. So if you look at the purpose of objection, the purpose of objection is so that the trial court can handle the issue instead of it being raised for the first time on appeal. This presumably young defense counsel eventually identified the exact error, and she mentioned it in her 1105s. The SJA and the convening authority could have sent it back to the military judge in order to make that determination, but the SJA erroneously advised the convening authority that it was an erroneous objection, if you will. So that's why it never comes back. But where the government, as Judge Stufi, you were asking earlier, where the government's primary weakness in this case was, and is today, is what they refused to even argue in their brief, what they refused to even mention, the dichotomy incorporated in the manual in 1984, and still holds true today, between the missing movement of a unit and the missing of a specific flight. When the government charged a specific charge, they both identified and limited the offense. The military judge changed that in her findings after all the evidence had been received, after the defense counsel argued specifically against the charge language, and she incorporated or she injected a fundamental due process violation as a result. Thus, this court should test for prejudice. As a starting point for prejudice, this court has looked at notice quite a bit in the last 5 years. Just last year in Tunstall, this court found due process mandates that an accused has a right to know what offense and under what legal theory he will be convicted. Sergeant Treat's defense counsel attacked this charge through an elements-based defense. The second of eight government witnesses was First Sergeant Barker. The government put First Sergeant Barker on the stand in order to prove that specific flight as alleged, TA-4B-702. The defense counsel immediately stands up and she destroys the government's case as it pertains to that offense because three of the four elements of Article 87 require that specific flight be proven. She shows that First Sergeant Barker has no knowledge of what the flight number was, and she shows the only reason he was able even to mention it in court is because he looked at a non-authenticated manifest that was printed some 30 days after the flight. Once she destroys that evidence, she immediately moves on to the desertion offense. Captain Rooney, Sergeant Treat's company commanders, put on next for the same purpose, to prove the specific flight. Here, the defense counsel is so successful in preventing him from ever testifying to it that the military judge sustains the objections and he's never able to relay the flight number. So the only question she directs to Captain Rooney or to his squad leader, Sergeant Mathis, the fourth witness, as it relates to the missing movement charge, is that there was a flight that was supposed to leave on the 17th. It did not, and Sergeant Treat knew about it. Otherwise, her focus was solely on the desertion offense as it dealt with those witnesses. As I already said, once she gets to her closing argument, her focus is on, hey, the government didn't prove this. She only spends a paragraph and a half out of 6 pages on the 87 offense. She says over and over again, the government couldn't prove it, the government couldn't prove it. In fact, they proved it never existed on the 17th, and Sergeant Shrink was told to stand down. It was a different flight that ends up taking off.
Now, are you arguing, counsel, that there's some import to the fact that we're talking about November 17th or November 19th?
I think it's important in this case, Your Honor, and often, and the government makes a good point that we have an on or about date, but the problem in this case is there's multiple flights going on between the 17th and the 19th. We know there was a flight scheduled for the 17th that gets canceled. We know they show up at Ramstein Air Base on the 19th. They're expecting to fly in a short period of time. That gets delayed for another 12 to 18 hours, and it's not clear to, I think, Captain Looney whether that was because multiple flights got canceled or changed. So there's a lot of flights we're talking about. So when you're talking about on or about, it becomes more important when you're given a specificity of a flight number, as opposed to, say, Hunt, where we have a rape charge, but there was only one rape in a three-week period. There was an Article 32 hearing to put the defense on notice to what rape charge we're talking about. And when you're looking at those cases that don't involve prejudice, you have cases like Hunt, or the government argues Johnson over and over again. But Johnson was an early 1953 case. The charge was very broad, simply to, hey, you missed movement to Operation Longhorn. And what that court said is, since the defense counsel never asked for a bill of particulars, the government was free to prove it up in any manner, the mode of movement in any manner they wanted. Had the defense asked for a bill of particulars and the government provided an appropriate response, the clear inference is there is that the government would have been stuck with it. As this court said in Capel in 1993, the first element when you were charged with missing a movement of a specific flight requires proof that they missed that specific aircraft. That gets back to the prejudice analysis. I've kind of already talked about that the accused certainly didn't agree to the admitted charge. He defended against a different charge, and he didn't argue against the amended charge. But the government, in closing, at both 169 and then rebuttal closing in 178, continues to insist to the military judge that, hey, we had in fact proven this specific flight was missed. It's not until the judge delivers her opinion or through findings that it becomes clear that the defense counsel's argument had worked and her defense had worked, and that Sergeant Shreed now stands convicted of a different crime than that which he was charged. Any of your questions?
No further questions. Thank you, counsel. You'll have additional time on rebuttal. Counsel for the government, please.
Chief Judge Baker, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Daniel Carnot, and along with co-counsel Major Robert Rodriguez, we represent the United States in this case. The military judge did not commit plain error by making exceptions and substitutions, as the gist or the core of the offense of Article 87 UCMJ lies within the movement itself and not the mode of movement. Furthermore, even assuming error, the record demonstrates that appellant was not prejudiced, as his theory of defense was based on a theory of impossibility, where the mode of moving is irrelevant as to that defense.
So, counsel, what's the government's position on waiver?
If this court finds that by not objecting to the military judge's findings when she rendered them, that constituted waiver, then obviously this court can find waiver in this case. At best, defense has conceded that it's plain error because it's forfeited under the law. Does that answer your question?
Did the government argue waiver before the CCA?
We did, Your Honor. And I'd say probably about half the argument was focused on waiver at the CCA. We mentioned it in a brief here, but we mostly focused on the error itself and then prejudice analysis. The military judge did not commit plain error, as their exception to substitution properly kept the focus of the core of the offense on the movement itself and not the particular means of movement or descriptions thereof.
Well, but isn't the offense is missing a movement in one of two ways, as the manual explains?
We would disagree, Your Honor.
What is the offense?
The offense is the movement itself, as cited by U.S. v. Johnson, U.S. v. Graham. The explanations as defined by
so if you don't go, if you don't go, it doesn't make any difference how you don't go. Or if you go late, that's okay?
No, it variations such as changing the dates or the location, that can affect. Under U.S. v. Johnson, we know that they charge it as a movement to Operation Longhorn. It was just a movement. There's no mention of a unit.
But you're still stuck with how you charge the offense. That may be a correct statement of law, but you can't, the government can't just specify a specific offense with great clarity and then say after the fact, but it doesn't really matter what we put in the specification.
It's a notice issue. He's got to know what he's got to defend against.
Understood.
If he has to defend against, well, you didn't get from A to B in time. You got a spec that said he missed the movement of flight X. Now you got a spec that says he missed the movement of whatever flight this unit or most of this unit or some of this unit went on.
As to notice, Your Honor, what was left over of the specification after the substitution or exceptions were made was that at a certain time and place, a flight happened. Now, they took away the TAB 702 Bravo language and they put a flight dedicated to the transport of
a unit.
Would you agree that that's broader language than the initial specification had?
We would agree it's broader, yes, Your Honor, except that...
So if you thought that you were going to defend against a very specific particular fact and you were found guilty of a much broader set of facts, you don't think that that's problematic just in theory? I'm not talking about this particular case.
No, it could be problematic in theory. However, in this particular case, we know from the facts of the record show that the entirety of the defense that appellant prepared for was entirely based on this theory of a possibility that it was apparently abducted by Russian-speaking individuals.
That's a prejudice.
Yes, that goes to the prejudice side of things.
Would you agree that that's a stronger argument than that there was no error?
That is our strongest argument, yes, Your Honor. But particularly on the error, we focus, perhaps it's best to conceptualize this as you have three layers, essentially. You have what Johnson and Graham say is the core of the offense or the gist of the offense, the significant part of the offense, is the movement itself. On top of that, you have the different modes of movement. You have aircraft, ship, and by unit. And on top of even that, you have descriptions thereof. So in this case, the military judge, by her exceptional substitutions, she did not affect the core or the movement itself. She did not even affect the flight. Her language, she kept the language, flight dedicated to the transport of the unit. So two levels removed from the core of the offense, all she was affecting was the description thereof, that third tier layer.
Counsel?
Yes, sir.
Since Johnson and Graham were decided quite a while ago, in 1984, the President made those additional explanatory comments in the manual and specifically defined the mode of movement to either a unit or a ship or an aircraft, and specifically said that when you're charged with missing a particular flight, it's essential in establishing the offense of missing that flight. So here, it seems to me that the President has changed somewhat the older precedent of this court, and the government now is asking us to consider that older precedent and seemingly ignore the manual.
Well, the government would point back to that the statute is what governs. The MCM can't affect what the actual statute says. And what this court has said in case law, starting with Johnson, continuing through Graham, and even cases today or recently, such as U.S. v. Smith, still cite to that proposition that it's a mismoved, not the mode of movement that's significant.
Do you see the 1984 amendments to be consistent with Johnson and Graham?
Yes, Your Honor. And actually, if you look at the analysis portion of Article 87, back at the back part of the manual, it actually specifically quotes that this provision was created because of Graham, Johnson, lists two other cases, and then goes back to the CCA decision in Graham. So MCM was actually perhaps somewhat inartfully, we believe the way they described the separation of defenses perhaps that second offense talking about, or the second theory that you can charge either aircraft or ship, that was mostly created for individual employers. And if you see, there was a line of cases that, starting World War II, obviously we had these issues, and that's the whole reason Article 87 was created, was because most of these situations we had soldiers moving as parts of units to, the European theater, what have you, that was the major issue. And eventually you had some cases come out between the 50s and 70s that said, well, because it's so based on unit, the only time you can have a ship or crew, ship or aircraft situation is where the individual's a member of the crew. Now Grant came and said, no, since Vietnam we've had, and during peacetime, the major reason that we have Article 87, one of the major reasons we charge this, is individual deployers, either on PCS or deployments, going by themselves as essentially to their unit, not as part of the unit. So that it's essentially expanded this out from what, under Johnson, what the law was. So this expansion, we agree that Graham talks about that, and the MCM talks about that as well. But that expansion should apply only to individualized deployers or individualized personnel going on a PCS or permanent change of station. It doesn't apply to this case, where the soldier is a member of a unit and deploying or moving with that unit.
So there's a different rule for the onesies and twosies than there is for an entire unit.
Essentially, that's what Graham
and where did that?
Yes, sir.
Is that addressed in the MCMs anywhere?
No. It talks about the two different types, but it just says, I believe, a person. Perhaps the MCM would have been specific if it said individual deployer or person. But again, we point to that as the MCM has persuasive authority, it's a statute that governs, and this court has repeatedly said.
If the statute's broad enough to embrace both interpretations. The statute was, the MCM is not contrary to the statute. That's not the government's argument.
No, we're not arguing,
okay.
Your Honor. It's just that what we're saying here is appellant's interpretation that the MCM has essentially split Article 87 into a dichotomy where you have essentially two offenses. You can only go one way or another. We'd say it's more as I know Chief Judge Baker likes to talk about Venn diagrams. This is expanded out.
Thanks.
Article 87. It hasn't separated the two. And thus it's peculiar that appellant now argues that a member of a unit, as appellant is here, cannot be charged as a flight, especially when the military judge did not even change the language of the flight. She kept that language.
Well, then why wasn't he charged with missing a unit movement?
I mean, he could have, Your Honor, and obviously we wouldn't be here if the government did that, but we're arguing that the government has still the option to use a flight or ship, even if they're moving as a part of it. Now, in their reply brief, appellant talks about essentially that Graham and Johnson are these aged cases. But as we already talked about, we know that other cases, including U.S. v. Smith and other cases cited by the Navy and Air Force courts, Adder and Holden, still cite to this part that it's important that the mode of movement is a significant part. Excuse me, the missing movement, not the mode of movement, is a significant part. So essentially, Graham and Johnson are still good law, and the core of the offense lies within the movement itself. The military judge did not commit plain error, as there's no material variance. I'm moving to prejudice, unless there's any other questions on error. Even if this court determines that the military judge committed plain error, the appellant cannot establish prejudice. And we know from U.S. v. Marshall, as cited in this court, and also the Supreme Court, Berger versus the United States, that the true inquiry, the critical question here, is one of prejudice. Here the record demonstrates that there's no material prejudice for the following two reasons. First, the appellant's primary theory of defense centered on impossibility based on his alleged abduction by these unknown Russian-speaking individuals. And second, and probably most importantly, this theory of impossibility is equally effective no matter what mode of transportation or description thereof is proved or not proved by the government. Now, despite how appellant might seek to recharacterize the record, they cannot change the fact that the sole defense theory going into the case was entirely based upon this theory of impossibility due to abduction. The theme of defense's opening statement was, the truth was stranger than fiction. Nothing in defense's opening statement even referenced anything about flight numbers. They did not raise RCM 917 motion at the close of Garvin's case. During their case in chief, they presented three witnesses. All went to their alleged...
Well, of course, they couldn't have, in their opening statement, known that the government would be unable to prove it.
No, Your Honor. Okay. But this shows...
So that's irrelevant.
It shows that, from a notice perspective, they did not go in just basing their whole defense on, oh, we know that that flight never existed.
Well, counsel, do you agree that no evidence that that flight existed was presented at trial?
The government did, to the extent that I believe it was one of the NCOs or the first sergeant, I believe it was the first sergeant, looked at an unauthenticated manifest with a number on it and then said, oh, yeah, that was it. But then the military judge further clarified what he originally said he didn't remember. I mean, there's very minimal evidence as to the actual flight number, but there is at least a little bit, some evidence.
So if there's no evidence of an element of a specification, is the proper thing for the military judge to do to change the specification or to dismiss it for failure to prove the offense?
I wouldn't characterize it as a change of the elements, more a part of the description of the flight, if that makes any sense. I believe that she kept the language, the flight, describing the transport or dedicated to the transport of 54th Engineers Battalion. So in that way, she kept at least, even if what appellant is arguing is true, and the core of the defense has shifted, evolved into the mode of moving, her exception substitution still kept it at that third tier level. It's still a description thereof. She kept it as a flight.
What if the unit instead of moving on this flight had turned around, filed onto the Queen Mary, and lumbered across the ocean? Would that make any difference?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
But then it wouldn't have been the flight dedicated to
it. No, then it would have been the boat dedicated.
If it was charged as flight originally and then...
Right, and they ended up on the Queen Mary.
Well, in this case, there was actually somewhat similar to that in the record. It shows that the appellant's unit was actually transported via bus first. And then went to one location.
And so, bus with the tag number 93.
Well, exactly. I mean, usually with deployments, it's not just, you know, everybody shows up at the airport on the, you know, purple ramp in this case, and then loads up. It usually has a number of intermediate stopping points. So it just goes to show that to charge it to, you know.
But do answer the question, what if it got switched from flight to Queen Mary? Wouldn't that be prejudicial? You'd have to go figure out whether the Queen Mary was still afloat and blah, blah, blah. And
it could be if defense came in and based their whole defense on that. But
if the defense comes in, right, thinking that the only defense that they have is the possibility that they were abducted, right, and then they get to trial, and it turns out that what the specification says the government can't prove, why isn't that prejudicial if the military judge changes it? To something because, that the government can prove.
Well, it could be if the variance is so material that it essentially did not allow defense to present a case.
Is it a notice issue, or is it a how precise does it line up with the defense theory issue? What are we actually testing for here?
Well, I mean, I think notice goes more towards the error, and then on the prejudice side of things, it's what defense has presented or not presented as their actual defense. And we know here, and even the record was so clear, in fact, that ACCA found as a finding of fact that they found that appellant's primary defense here, using their language, and later they described it as the thrust of appellant's defense at trial, was the abduction. Unless this court finds that finding of fact clearly erroneous, this court should be bound to it.
Well, it sounds like they should have pleaded in Trover and they pleaded in Replevin.
knew what
that's like a Venn diagram. It's a math term.
I would like to answer that.
No, that sounds like election or remedies, and that, like the defense has somehow got a duty to, you know, they put the defense forward, and then the government hands them a huge gift by not proving an element of the offense. But no. You wanted Trover, and we gave you Replevin, and you're out.
You can answer yes or no to that.
Lastly, the last major point is that even if Appellant's abduction story by these Russian-speaking men was true, such a story or defense would be just as effective no matter what type of movement, whether it was the Queen Mary, the, you know, aircraft TAV, whatever, or unit, whatever unit it was. All that matters in such theory is a time frame. And we know that Appellant argued that he was abducted from 15 October, and then he was released apparently on 15 November, and was released 5 days later on 20 November. Now, given that the movement was originally scheduled on 17 November, but ultimately flew on 19 November and was charged on or about, such an impossibility defense would have been a valid defense against the unit theory or an aircraft theory had it actually been true. We know the court found that it wasn't. And so Appellant cannot establish prejudice, as his defense theory he prepared for and presented at trial did not hinge on the motive movement or even a description thereof. Pending any further questions, that concludes my brief.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the appellant, please.
Chief Judge Baker, three quick points. Judge Olson, you asked the government about what they argued below, and I think my friend with the government may be confused accidentally between waiver and forfeiture. On page 6 of the brief to the Army Court, the government actually, they used the word waiver, but immediately after they said plain error. The Army Court then found in footnote 1 that this was not waived, and we have proffered that's law of the case, that the government did not appeal that issue, just like they did not appeal any decision by the Army Court saying this was actually he was convicted of missing the movement of a unit. The judge brought in some questions that you were asking the government counsel had to do with the core of the offense, and the reason that the government counsel had problems answering the question about Queen Mary, because if he did so, he would basically concede that the core of the offense is broader than the government now alleges. If you look at the language of Article 87 and the explanation by the President, the President said in that explanation, missing a particular flight is essential to establish the offense of missing movement when that specific aircraft is charged. So it's beyond belief that that particular aircraft could be essential, yet it's not part of the core of the offense. It also doesn't comport with the other case laws, such as Marshall. In that case, we had escape from custody from a specific individual. This court didn't say, well, the core of the offense is just the escape, so it didn't matter who he escaped from. The same would apply here. He was charged with missing a specific aircraft. That specific aircraft was essential to three of the four elements of the Article 87 offense and became the core of the offense. Judge Erdman, you asked the government about the manual, and the government said the manual can't affect the statute. It can't contradict the statute, and from that point, they're correct. And neither party briefed the hierarchy of rights, and this court's well aware of what those are. In 1998, this court decided Davis, and this court analyzed an unambiguous manual provision in Article 128. And what this court said was this court should abide by the President's decision unless it clearly contradicts the express language of the code. And that, of course, doesn't apply here because the express language of the code says ship, aircraft, uses the disjunctive, or unit. When the government chooses to charge one, and they chose to charge one, whether it was a good decision or not, they chose it. They're stuck with that decision. Could they have charged missing the movement of a unit, which is unimportant, as the regulation says, as the manual says, on the exact mode of movement? Yes, but they chose not to. And we don't see that this provision by the President is inconsistent with Johnson or Graham. It further expounds on it and explains it. Also looking at Davis, it found a couple other principles that caused this court to say, hey, even though this aggravated assault explanation is more restrictive than what the code allows or what the code says, and even though it's contrary to what civilian courts hold, This court was going to follow it because they give deference to the president's authority. There's no contradiction with the code. Congress hasn't tried to change it in this case, 30 years since it's been in place. And I think this one's very important as well. The fourth point was, since this interpretation is favorable to the appellant, we will not disturb the president's narrowing construction, which is an appropriate executive branch limitation on the conduct subject to prosecution. The appellant in this case relied on the charging decision of the government. The appellant relied on the language of the president in the manual, as is indicative of her argument at closing, which was focused on the government's inability to prove the specific flight. As a result, the appellant successfully defended against that crime charge, and he should have an opportunity to defend against the substantially different charge that the military judge ultimately convicted.
In your view, what should the government have done here when they realized they couldn't demonstrate the particular flight number and they wanted to proceed with the charge of missing a flight?
Yes, sir. I don't think there was really anything they could do other than maybe withdraw the charge. In Marshall, at the 917 motion, the government put on this new agency theory, and this court found, hey, that's too late.
So your answer is they should withdraw the charge?
They should withdraw the charge.
And would they have been barred from bringing it anew then?
Not when charged properly, which would have been the movement of a unit.
That would be the correct way to deal with such a circumstance.
Absolutely, Your Honor. We're not arguing that this charge couldn't be brought again.
Could they also have asked to make the change?
They could have asked it if the appellant had agreed. I mean, I don't know why he would have, because I believe it's a major change, but they certainly could have asked to do that. Any other questions?
No further questions. Thank you. The court thanks both counsel. The case is now submitted, and we stand in recess until further order of the court. Thank you very much.
Court is adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.